Good morning. As you can probably hear, I'm dealing with a cold, so I'll do the best I can with it. But I want to thank B'nai Torah for hosting Midrashat Yom Rishon. As I always say when I speak here, because it's always true, it's really a pleasure to have the Midrashat Yom Rishon program here at B'nai Torah. The shul is always very accommodating and puts out a very nice breakfast spread as well. And the turnout is always strong here at B'nai Torah. So really, I'm very happy that we are able to do this program here. I look forward to having more programs at B'nai Torah as the year goes on. The topic for the shiur now, the topic for this second half, is a relatively dry topic, which is okay because it's a Yardin wine, and you know they have a lot of those. It's a dry topic, but it's a topic that we need to know about because it happens every 7 years. You have wines show up at the liquor store here. It's the LCBO that say on them Otsar Beit Din. Or, if you prefer, Otsar Beis Din. And this is Shemitah wine. And the question that inevitably comes up after someone has bought it, or after someone has been given it as a gift, is, what exactly do I do with this? If this is Shemitah wine, are there any rules about how I use it? And the answer is, boy, are there rules. So what I want to do is take the next 30 to 35 minutes to talk about what this wine is, what its status is. We know that Shemitah, the sabbatical year, occurs every 7 years. This year is a Shemitah year. It involves limitations on what I harvest and how I treat it. In past Shemitah cycles, we've seen this Shemitah wine show up, and it's going to show up again, presumably in a couple of years. So the one thing I want to stipulate, because there's no time to go into this particular subtopic, is I'm assuming we're talking about grapes that actually come from what is called halachically the land of Israel. Meaning, there's a lot of debate regarding certain regions, in particular the northern Golan Heights. I'm not talking political debate. This, frankly, is none of their business. I'm talking about halachic debate about whether it counts. I'm assuming it does count for the purpose of this, conversation. So, if you take a look at your sheets, you see the top section is called From Grapevine to LCBO, Five Challenges, because there are five issues involved in harvesting and marketing Shemitah produce, which we have to address somehow in order to be permitted to use this wine. The first of the five is the issue of harvesting, and here, for simplicity's sake, I brought you sources from the Rambam, from Maimonides, and his codification of the law, as opposed to bringing you primary text going back to Gemara and so on, or instead of this being a 30-35 minutes here, this would become 3.5 hours. So we're going with Maimonides, who codified what we know. And he says in source number one, he says, that which the tree produces during Shemitah may not be gathered the way one gathers it every year. Because the Torah says, you shall not be botser. Botser is the term for harvesting grapes. You shall not be botser from your unpruned vines. So right off the bat, I have a problem, because you're not getting wine without harvesting grapes. If the Rambam is telling me I can't harvest it normally, then how are they getting the grapes? That's problem number one. And keep in mind, these bottles that are showing up are not bottles that are showing up without a hechsher on them. They have a hechsher on them. There are rabbis who are supervising this. So somehow they're dealing with the harvesting problem. The question is how. Second, if you take a look at source number two, there's another problem. Now that you have harvested your grapes, Rambam writes, "Einos in schar beperos shavias." You're not allowed to engage in commerce with Shemitah produce. V'imrotz alimkor me'at miperos shavias mocher. If you want to sell a little bit, you may. So the money that you get for it has the same status, the same holiness as Shemitah produce. And therefore, just like Shemitah produce must be consumed, you can't throw it out, so too the money must be used, as the Rambam continues, to buy food that you will then eat with the sanctity of Shemitah produce. So number one problem is, I'm not allowed to harvest. Incidentally, why am I not supposed to harvest it? I mean, the Rambam pointed out it's a pasuk, it's a verse. But why am I not supposed to harvest it? Because what is supposed to happen in Shemitah? It's supposed to be for everybody to be able to gather. Right? We had a Midrash at Yom Rishon at B'nai Torah actually last year when we talked about the goals of Shemitah, and one of the goals of Shemitah is to have everybody meet each other in the fields during the Shemitah year. It increases unity among the Jewish people. So one point is you can't harvest it, and then another point is you can't market it commercially because it's supposed to be for the needy. Right? You are now going to go marketing this. That's no good. That's problem number two. Problem number three, source number three, the Rambam writes, Pero Shmias, Ein Motzian Osan Meha'aretz L'chutzal Haaretz, no exporting Shemitah produce from Israel. Uh-oh. That's a rabbinic rule, as opposed to the previous two, which are biblical. But you're not allowed to export it. So that's certainly going to create a problem, because that's what they did. And then number four is an issue of using the wine and how I'm going to use it. Pero Shvius, source number four. Pero Shvius, Nidnu La'achila, Ulishisiya, Ulasicha, Ulahadlaka Saner, Ulitsivia. You're allowed to use Shemitah produce to eat and drink. You're allowed to use it to rub on your skin, to anoint, like if you have olive oil. That's fine. Ulahadlaka Saner. If it's oil you're going to use for a lamp, that's fine also. Litzvia, if it's for coloring something, that's fine also. The key is that it has to be a normal use of the item. If it's something that people normally eat, you have to eat it. You can't come up with some inventive way to use it that's going to destroy it. In the event that people normally anoint their skin with it, they rub it on their skin, so that's fine too. But the use has to be the normal use. Now, in and of itself, that's not a problem. You buy wine and you drink it. But there are other uses that people get from wine, right? What else do people use wine for? Cooking. And? Sorry? Baking. Okay. Havdalah. Very good. The Havdalah. People pour their Havdalah cup. Many people have the minhag of overfilling the cup, right? And then putting out a candle in it to boot. Right? Sound like you can do that with the Shemitah wine? Quick answer is no. It's a normal use for Havdalah, but it's not a normal use for wine. If you were to hold a bottle of wine, right, and say, what do I do with this? People's first reaction wouldn't be, I extinguish candles. I think. I mean, maybe if you really don't like wine, that's your use of wine for the week. But generally speaking, that won't qualify. It's a valid point, but generally speaking, it won't qualify for that. And then the fifth and last is the issue of biur. What does biur mean? What is biur? Removing? Sorry?
Getting rid of?
Okay, those are adequate translations. We use the term usually with biur chametz, right? Biur literally is to consume in a destructive way. They talk about animals eating things. It's also that same term is used regarding animals chewing up and destroying things. But it's some form of destruction. And indeed, we are told, if you take a look at source number 5, the Rambam's codification, you're only allowed to eat Shemitah produce as long as it is found in the field. Meaning, if I bring in grapes from the field, I'm allowed to eat those grapes only as long as there are grapes on the grapevine. Once there are no more grapes on the grapevine, when I am told that that's roughly the beginning of the month of Tammuz, is when there are no more grapes on the grapevine. You're talking about the summertime. Then for wine grapes specifically, not grapes for eating, but wine grapes specifically, sometime in the early to mid-summer is when they are off of the vine. At that point, you now have to get rid of your wine. Now, there are actually two different explanations for what beer means in this context. One view is that it means you actually have to destroy it. The other view is you have to make it what's called hefker. Hefker means ownerless. Anybody can take it. Take it out of your house, put it outside, and anybody can take it. What's the rationale for this mitzvah? So you don't hoard it and own it. Very good. And I'll take this opportunity to thank Mrs. Grisman for giving the first half of the program. Thank you. So, yes, this prevents people from gathering in the Shemitah produce and hoarding it for themselves. Okay, so we have five problems. You can't harvest it. You can't market it. You can't export it. If you have it, it has to be used in a proper way, in the normal way. And you have to destroy it or get it out of your property at the end of the cycle, the end of the year. So how is this all showing up in the LCBO with certification, with kosher certification? What is the story? And the answer is a remarkable communal solution, partial solution anyway, for the challenges of Shemitah. And it's called Otsar Beit Din, or, as I said before, Otsar Beis Din. An Otsar is a storehouse area. It's used for treasuries as well. And it's essentially a storage area set up by the courts. How in the world does this work? Take a look at source number 6. A very old source from a couple of thousand years ago, which describes what they used to do. Barishona, at first, Hayushluche Bezdin Yoshvin al Pischei Ayoros. Emissaries, agents of the local rabbinical court, would sit at the entrance to the town, and Kolmisha maybe Peros Pesoch Yado Notlin Osan Mimenu. People would come to them with produce that they had collected from the fields, and they would take it. Venose Lomehen Mazon Shalosh Seudos. And then they would give them 3 meals worth of food, which was people were allowed to take from the fields, and the rest, Vashar, Machnisun Osolo Otsur Shebair. They would put it in a storehouse in the city. Right? Who does this sound like? Coming up in the Parsha very shortly? Yosef. Right? It's the Yosef strategy. So everybody's gonna bring in some, they're gonna get a few meals worth, and the rest is going to go into communal storage. Higiyas man te'enim, the time comes for figs. Shluch ebezdin sochrin polim, the agents of the court would then hire workers, odrin or orin osan, they would then go out into the fields to gather whatever was left of the figs. Vosin osan tevela, they made them into cakes, which was the standard use of figs. Vekonsin osan v'chavios, they would store them in barrels. Vemachnisin osan la'otzer shebe'ir, and they would put them into the storage area. And then it goes on to list a whole bunch of other types of produce, including grapes. And then, umechalkin mehen arvei shabasos kol echad ve'echad levi beso. They would then distribute it every Friday. Every Friday they would give out this produce. What does this solve? I'm just going to give this sheet because I see people don't have it.
It solves the waste.
It solves the waste problem in what sense?
You've got, let's say, a field full of figs. Figs have a very short shelf life. And the normal use of them was to preserve them as pressed cakes.
Right.
If you don't allow the owner to harvest it, there's a very narrow window when anybody might be able to take some, but the person who has the equipment to make the fig cakes can't make it, and the crop is going to waste. So the base team is going to collect the crop, going to preserve it, and then going to distribute it to the city.
Right, so it sounds like an efficient way to do it. You're centralizing the process. Yes, Elaine?
So if this way it's ownerless, you don't have to worry about
owner worrying about? You're right.
About, about one person harvesting it because it was done through
right. We are told, then we're going to come back to this in a moment, but we are told that you're not supposed to harvest personally, but it isn't being done by an individual. It's now being done by the rabbinical court. And they, for reasons we'll get to in a second, are able to do that which us normal people are not licensed to do. They can harvest this en masse. They will also have, there's more to be said about this, but I want to stipulate one thing. The court Well, two things. Number one, the court is described as paying people to do the work. Right? Where are they getting the money? How is the court getting money for this? Sorry? How are they getting money from the produce? You can't sell Shemitah produce. Sorry? From the years before? Who in the world gives rabbinical courts money?
Is it a tax?
Is it a tax? So, it's understood that perhaps, going back to the time of the Beis HaMikdash, going back to temple times, you had a half shekel collection, and that would go in part to fund this sort of thing. But what do you do post-temple when you don't have a half shekel donation? So the answer is, the way this is practiced today, is that people buy the produce instead of having be distributed by the courts. But you're not allowed to buy produce. What are you doing? So what they do is, and I know people are going to laugh, but this is the way it works, is the court says, look, it costs us X amount to hire workers. It costs us Y amount for packaging, distribution efforts, plus our time as we're invested in it. So what we're going to do is, we're going to charge the consumer for our efforts, the wages of the workers who did this work, the cost of the packaging, whatever it is, whatever our costs are. Now, it may be that a bottle of wine in a normal year is $19, and it ends up being $19 this year. And people will look at it and say, well, that's kind of funny. Nonetheless, realistically, your costs for doing this may end up being higher than a regular year because you have less supply. Law of supply and demand means your costs may indeed go up, and therefore what people are actually going to have to pay for the bottle is going to match what they normally pay when they're actually paying for the grapes. But that's one point that's worth noting. The other point is, this works not just for grapes. It works for all tree fruit, and it works for vegetables that took root before the Shemitah year. Vegetables that take root during the Shemitah year cannot benefit from this procedure. And the reason for that is that there's a rabbinic decree against using things that grow wild during Shemitah, if they took root during Shemitah, because apparently at some point in Jewish history, this is going to come as a shock, there were people who planted things in their fields during Shemitah, and they told everybody, oh no, this just grew wild. It just grew on its own. And they were bringing in fields of tomatoes and saying, yeah, it's amazing, it just all grew. So they made a decree and said, if it takes root during Shemitah, we're not going to use it. So therefore, this isn't going to work for that. Oats or Beis Din is not a perfect solution. But it is a solution for tree fruit. And it is a solution for vegetables that took root before Shemitah. So that's the Oats or Beis Din method. The court hires people. The people do the harvesting. The court then hires workers to process the items, and then it sends out, it distributes the whatever the production was, in our case, wine, and sells it to people, and what they're buying is not the fruit, what they're buying is, so to speak, is the work that was done on the fruit. Everyone clear on how this works? Okay. I warned you this was going to be dry. But why does this work? What's the logic in it? So Rabbi Avram Yeshaya Karel, it's also known as Chazon Ish, explained it at the bottom of the first side of your sheet. He quotes this Tosefta that we saw in source number 6. And he says, Meha disanyad b'Tosefta, from what we saw in that source number 6, De bizman sheyesh otzar al pi bezdin dorchin hanavim begas v'zeisim v'zeisabad, that when they have this otzar based in, the storage area run by the court, then they're able to trample the grapes in a wine press. They're able to squeeze the olives in the olive press. So Shem Inon, we see from there, the hadisnan shein dorchin hanavim begas hayu davka bailim. What we learn from that is a very important point. What we learn from that is that the prohibition against harvesting normally and processing normally is only applicable to the owner of the field, not anybody else. People who go into the field and just get, they're able to do whatever they want. When the Torah says don't harvest, meaning don't harvest in the manner of harvesters, that's speaking to the owner of the field. In other words, to explain it outside of the text, what Chazon Ish is suggesting is, an interesting philosophical point. When the Torah says I'm not supposed to harvest during the Shemitah year, there are two ways I could take that. One way I could take that is to mean no harvesting. God doesn't want you to harvest Shemitah produce, period. It's not to be done. The other way to look at it is that it's a function of ownership. God doesn't want the owner of the field to do things which demonstrate ownership. Because one of the lessons of Shemitah is that we don't have permanency. That it's not really ours. One of the lessons of releasing the land every 7 years is to say, this isn't really yours. If the owner can go out into the field, notwithstanding the fact that he's letting everybody else in, but he's able to go out with his equipment, which he has right there by the field, and he's able to harvest normally, that defeats the point. Now you're saying, yes, this field is mine. But if other people do that, outsiders do that, if they get grapes and they process the grapes, everybody knows they don't own the field. That's not an act of ownership. And therefore, it's okay. So writes the Chazon Ish. Not everybody agrees with him. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach disagreed with him, for example. Nonetheless, that seems to be a key element in the way Otzer Beis Din is done, allowing them to harvest the grapes, because it's not the owner doing it, it's the court doing it. So the court can harvest the grapes normally and process them normally.
Why does the Beis Din have to get involved? It would seem, by that logic, that anyone other than the owner could do it. So why can't two neighbors just trade the harvesting of their crops?
Excellent point. I'm going to come back to that. That is an excellent, excellent point. You heard the question. Anybody could do this. You know, you could even have, as was suggested, a trade between neighbors. Right? Yeah. One neighbor will take care of this one's, and this one will take that one's. So we're going to come back to that.
Rabbi,
yes.
People that are hired to do this, are they Jews?
Ah, excellent. That was actually where I was going right now with this. So we're going to take that. We'll take that first in terms of who exactly we are hiring. You see, the way it works today, you know who Beis Din hires to do it? Nope, Jews. They're hiring Jews, but not just that. You know who they're hiring? The owners. They're hiring the owner of the field or the owner of the vines. Why are they doing that? Right. To give them parnassus, that they should survive, but also for another reason. They have a vested interest, but they're going to do the best job. They know the field. They know the vineyard. You're going to bring in people who haven't been there before and have to learn the harvest. That makes no sense. You have the people who know exactly where to look. They know which vines produce better. And they will be sensitive. One of the major concerns that farmers have in Shemitah is allowing people at random to come into their field and potentially destroy things if they don't pick properly. Right? Because the person walking in doesn't care what happens for the next 6 years. So the farmer is going to be careful. His employees, who he has year after year, they're going to be careful. So they're actually hiring the farmers themselves, and the farmers have certain ways in which they're allowed to take care of the grapevines. There are certain things you're allowed to do in order to make sure the fruit will be okay on the grapevine. There is some debate as to how exactly this will be done. One point of debate is, let's say the rabbinical court gets in there, and they say, they put up a big sign at the entrance, now under the auspices of Otzer Beis Din. Are other people, random people, allowed to come in and collect the way they normally do during a Shemitah year? So that's actually subject to debate. The Chazon Ish and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, no, you can't keep other people out. All the other people are still able to come in and collect. Others disagree. But that's one point of dissension. Second is whether the workers are allowed to maintain the vines. Rav Kook says the workers are not allowed to maintain the vines. You know why? He says the only reason we permit certain actions to maintain trees and vines during Shemitah is because we're worried about loss for the owners. But now it's all hefker. It's all ownerless. You're not losing anything. You don't own it. So therefore, you can't actually maintain it. That was Rav Kook's argument. The Chazon Ish, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, disagreed and said, no, you have to be able to maintain it because you need grapes for this year. And that's what you're doing. Third is the debate about hiring the farmers themselves. And there Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, said not to hire the farmers themselves, but others, as I mentioned, are okay with it. So that's the basic system of Otzer Beis Din. Okay? What's happening now, and what you're seeing on that label, is that the rabbinical court goes in there, they hire, generally speaking, the farmers themselves to do the work of maintaining things and of harvesting. They collect the produce, they hire people to distribute the produce, and they sell it for the price of their investment. So there are three objections that come up in general with this. Objection number one is that it looks like a joke. I mean, you're looking at this and really, you can't really tell the difference between what happens this year and what happened last year. To which the response is, look, if it works, it works. You know, if it fits the law, then you are enabling people to survive financially. You are potentially enabling people as well to observe Shemitah properly. And let's not forget, Shemitah in our day, as things are right now, is fundamentally rabbinic. So therefore, there's room for greater leniency. The second challenge that's brought is that Rambam never mentions it. Rambam does not discuss it at all. And generally speaking, Rambam codifies everything related to Shemitah. Why didn't he mention Otzer Beis Din? So if you take a look at source number 8, Rabbi David Ibn Avi Zimra, writing in the 16th century, he says, yeah, the Hishmina Tosefta, Rambam omitted the Tosefta about the agents of the Beis Din and so on, Lefisha Eina Halacha, because it's not the law. He says, if the Rambam doesn't like it, there's no way that this is going to be the law. Alternatively, he says, if you go back to the Tosefta in source number 6, do you catch the first word? The first word was Barishona. At first, they used to do this. Meaning, as Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon explains, this made more sense when you had a Beis HaMikdash, when you had a temple, and you had a half shekel donation. And that was how you funded it. It's considerably less legit in an age when the consumer is paying for this produce. So that's a second argument, is that the Rambam didn't mention it, it must not be valid. However, there are responses to this. One response to this is what Mrs. Witte pointed out before. This really isn't a great novelty. When you think about it, if this is founded on the idea that I can harvest in someone else's field, that's not news. So to speak, the Rambam discusses who can harvest in whose field. All you've done is come up with a strategy to use that. You've made it a community-wide thing instead of a personal thing. But the Rambam didn't need to mention it. There's no groundbreaking law involved. And that's the response that that some bring. Excuse me. Others point out that even if the Rambam disagrees, Ramban, Nachmanides quoted it, Rash Mishans, who is one of the authors of the Tosfot in the 13th century, quoted it. They were comfortable with it, so maybe a debate. But since Shemitah is rabbinic, maybe I don't have to follow the Rambam. Rabbi Tzion Abba Shaul, former Sephardi chief rabbi of the State of Israel, noted that ultimately, people who depend on this do have someone to depend on when they do this. And therefore, he says, you're entitled to buy from them. Even if you follow the Rambam and you believe that the Rambam is against it, the people who did it had legitimate authorities to depend on, and therefore you're not causing them to stumble by buying from them. But that was the second challenge, was the Rambam. The third challenge is that the way it was described in source number 6 was that the distribution was done by the court itself. Right? Not in stores. So some actually require that the distribution be done in a special facility of the court. The Rav Nissim Karelitz does not allow selling it in stores. Rav Yosef Shalom Eliashiv permitted it in with certain conditions. So, getting towards the final wrap-up here. What we have is this Otzer Beis Din, rabbinical court, solution of harvesting the produce, marketing the produce. We have certain caveats in terms of how we are how we're going to be allowed to do it. Can you do it in a court? Can you not? I'm sorry, can you do it in a store? Or are you not allowed to do it in a store? Are you allowed to hire the farmers? Not allowed to hire the farmers. So let's take 5 minutes and look at it now in the context of our question. What do I do with oats are based in wine? Are you with me? Somewhat. When we see it in the practical circumstance, it may also clarify certain things. So number one, in terms of harvesting. So the Chazon Ish said, Rav Yeshaya Karel, it's writing in the 1950s in Israel, said, yes, you're allowed to harvest it normally. And he seeks to prove it even from source number 6 that showed that they were harvesting and processing it normally. So therefore, even though we said in the beginning, challenge number 1, you're not allowed to harvest Shemitah produce, nonetheless, if it's being done by the rabbinical court or by some outsider, it seems to be fine. Problem number 2, the problem of doing business with it. You're not doing business with it, right? You're not selling Shemitah produce. What you're doing is taking money for your effort. The produce itself has no value in this transaction. Practical application beyond wine, esrog sales. When esrogim come in from Israel after Shemitah. So there's something that's a longer discussion called a closed box sale, in which you're not allowed to look at the esrog. You have to take it on faith that it's a kosher esrog, and that's just the way it is. Because that underscores the idea that you're not paying for this esrog. There's more to it in terms of how esrog sales work. But, yes?
So what is the concept of
the only thing you could maybe say is that you will be able to... No, even that you can't. Everyone's going to be buying esrogim on a different system for that year. There's more to be said about it. We're actually doing a program, God willing, on, I think, December 25th. A program on how the Estrogim are going to be sold after Shemitah. So if you're interested, it'll be the morning of December 25th. But that's in terms of marketing. Exporting the wine. What do you do about exporting this wine? Are you allowed to do it? So the answer is no. The answer seems to be no. When the rabbis put their hashgacha, when they certify this wine, it's understood that, yes, right now where it is kosher. The wine should not be exported. However, as the Chazon Ish notes in source number... However, it is still permissible for us, despite the fact that it wasn't supposed to be exported, nonetheless, that doesn't render the product prohibited. However, what I brought you in the Chazon Ish in source number 11, which is brought from the Rambam himself, which is brought from the Yerushalmi, is that you're not allowed to move it from one place to another within Galus, outside of Israel. You're not allowed to move it from one place to another. Now, what defines a place is a really good question. Can I move it from here to Thornhill? What do you mean when you say place? Is not at all clear cut. I have some thoughts on it, but it would take us beyond the scope of the discussion right now. But the answer is it shouldn't have been exported, but that doesn't damage its kashrut. It's still kosher. Because there are things that I'm not allowed to do that don't fundamentally render the item that I dealt with off limits. That's true in many areas of halacha. There are things I'm not allowed to do, and once I've done them, you can't benefit from the product at all. So, for example, if I walk into a room and turn on a light on Shabbos, then I can't stay in the room and use the light and say, oh, well, the light's on. However, this is the type of act which, based on the sources that I didn't bring on here, of course, does not prohibit the actual item. The item is still permitted. I think it's because fundamentally exporting it is a rabbinic prohibition, and it wasn't designed as a prohibition that would actually prohibit the product. In other words, I think even the exporter himself is allowed to drink it, having exported it. I think it's just the way the rabbis designed this particular prohibition that was their creation. What about using the wine? So, drinking the wine is fine, but because it is Shemitah wine, one would not be allowed to, I'm sorry, one would be allowed, sorry, one would be allowed to cook with it. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach ruled that cooking with Shemitah wine is fine. However, for Havdalah, one is not allowed to overspill.
You cook with it, you have to finish everything you're eating.
Yes, you may need to drink some. And you have to make sure that you drink the last bit of wine that's in the bottle. That's part of the rules. Now, is there going to end up being a drop left in the bottle? Generally speaking, there is, just because of friction. You know, there's stuff that won't pour out at the end. The general rule with Shemitah produce is that if you leave it until it goes bad, then at that point you can dispose of it. So I suppose you could leave the open bottle with the last drop in it for a week or two, and then eventually it'll turn, and then you're fine. I suppose you could do that if you wanted to. The last bit is the issue of biur. Biur does not apply, this mitzvah of leaving it out, does not apply when it's in the hands of the court. Because at that point it is hefker, it is ownerless. But once you get it, it is subject to those rules. Generally speaking, by the time you get it, grapes are already gone from the vineyard in Israel. And therefore what you would have to do, having this bottle, is put it outside, leave it for a significant period of time, and then you can take it back in if no one has taken it. What is a significant period of time? So I've heard one rabbi say overnight. Overnight. You leave the bottle out overnight, and not this time of year necessarily, and then you can come back. The idea is leave it out long enough that someone could have really taken it. It really has to be available for the world. Leaving it out does not mean I left it right by my front door so that people will feel uncomfortable taking it. It means you leave it out in a way in which people could actually get it. So that's what we're saying here. What we're saying is, number one, your best solution is to buy other Israeli wines. The Otzer based in wine is going to get you into trouble. If you get it, if someone gives it to you for Shalach Manos, right, it could happen. Although hopefully not someone who's here. But what you need to remember is, number one, leave it out so that it'll be available for people. Anybody can take it. And drink the whole bottle. Use the whole bottle. Those are the two points that you need to remember at the end of the day. So
it's not really going to be a problem this year.
Correct. Yes, I was actually wondering when I wrote on the title 2015 whether that would be accurate, but that's what I wrote on the title. But yes, you will know because it will be marked. It will be marked. Oats are based in Shemitah wine, so you'll see it on it. But that's essentially the set of issues that are involved. Thank you so much. I apologize for being very dry with this, but that's the topic. Sorry? Yeah, you can buy other Israeli from other years. Israeli wine from other years. Continue to support the Israeli wine industry, just, you know, not with this. Sorry? Well, they can do it in Israel without the exporting issues, number one, right? So you solved your export problem. But number two, Israelis are much more familiar with how to do this. Israelis don't freak out when you tell them you have to use the whole thing and all that. They're doing this all year long. So, my advice on this is primarily because people here are not used to this and don't really know what to do with it. By the way, we are at the 11:20 mark. So if anybody has to leave, I'm not insulted. I'm going to take questions, but if you have to go, it's okay. Yes.
Is there no cultivation of the vines during a Shemitah year at all?
So you're allowed to do certain tasks which are involved in upkeep of the vine in order to make sure that it will remain healthy. What the specifics are of what you can do, I haven't studied in enough depth to be able to say offhand.
So I'm thinking not only of vines, of citrus trees, for example.
Same story. Maintenance is okay. Maintenance is okay. And again, there are certain tasks that you are allowed to do. Watering of certain kinds and so on are permitted. The goal is not to destroy everything in the field. The goal is not to lose the orchard. The goal is simply that we make it ownerless for the year. We don't do acts of ownership. That's all. Yes?
What about the sediment from the grapes? You know, when you wine, what happens with
What are they doing? I don't know. I don't know. It's a good question. What do they do with the sediment when they process it, when they actually manufacture this? Could be they find some use for it. But I don't know. What happens normally with sediment? No, in other words... I don't know. It's a good question. Okay? Thank you very much.